Thought I'd dedicate this session to issues of mature women, and these days there's a lot of talk and controversy and concern about osteoporosis and menopause. I thought first maybe we should talk a little bit about osteoporosis, what it is, what we can do to prevent it, a little bit about what we do to treat it, since some of that is pretty controversial. Osteoporosis, simply put, is a decrease in the mineral content of bone, weakening it. And there are two different types of bone. There's the type of bone that you find in the long bones, such as the humerus and the radius and the ulna and the femur and the tibia and fibula. And then there's the type that's called trabecular bone. And then there's calcineous bone, which is more what's found in the spine. And the things that will cause or prevent mineral loss in one place don't necessarily work too well in the other place. And that complicates things, especially when we're trying to diagnose osteoporosis. Who is at risk? Nobody cares exactly what the content of your bone is. The number isn't the thing that matters. What matters is, will it break or won't it break? Under normal circumstances. Bone is formed, of course, throughout childhood, and we keep telling our kids to drink your milk, drink your milk, drink your milk. But up to about age 30 or 35, we can still put calcium in our bones. And this is why it's important to have a good calcium intake, and in this country, and for those of us of Northern European extraction, that usually means milk and milk products. You can get quite a bit of calcium from leafy green vegetables. You can get them from eating the types of fish that we process to the point where the bones are digestible. Your canned salmon, your canned sardines, etc. If you pick the bones out, they're no better than anything else, but if you make a salmon loaf or something and eat them, they're okay. The problem, go ahead, I'm sorry.
One was that our pediatrician, what was in my kids are very prone, but when they were little, he said that they don't eat yolk.
Okay.
It's not necessary. Why?
Okay. Well, obviously a balanced diet is important, and that we need all different kinds of foods. People who cannot drink milk, and for us Northern Europeans, there are fewer of us that lose our ability to drink milk than there are among other groups, such as those from Southern Europe or from Africa or from Asia. Most of them become milk intolerant at approximately age 2. There is a sugar in milk called lactose, which is digested by a specific enzyme in the body. And there are two forms of that enzyme, one that's active in infancy, so that almost any infant, with very rare exceptions, can handle lactose, especially if it comes from breast milk, from a human source. But somewhere around the time of weaning, the child loses that form and goes to the adult form, which is not present in some ethnic groups, principally in this country among blacks and Southeast Asians. Now, traditionally in those cultures, they have not been herders or milk users, and so that enzyme has not been of any evolutionary benefit to them, and if they lost it, no big deal. They tended to get their calcium from green vegetables. Our Southeast Asian population, and we have a very close-knit Hmong population from northern Laos in our community. They don't drink milk at all, zero zip. And I really worried about my pregnant moms, especially when they have babies, you know, every 18 months, you know, what was happening to their bones. But what the nutritionists were able to tell us is they do eat a lot of greens. They wilt greens and stir-fry kinds of things. And we're talking about not lettuce. Lettuce is vastly overrated for just about anything. But, you know, your bok choy and your broccoli and your spinach and things of that sort do have a fair amount. Also, some soybeans that are processed appropriately, so people who eat a lot of tofu and things of that sort. And the soy milks, some of our both health food nuts and people who like dairy-type things, but don't tolerate lactose, we'll use that. Many partially lactose intolerant people can tolerate milk products if the enzyme is added to them or given separately. So they actually sell milk in the grocery store that's had this enzyme added to it so that that sugar begins to break down. It doesn't taste the way we're used to because you can taste the number of molecules of sugar. And when lactose is broken down, it's broken from one molecule to two. So all the lactose is doubly sweet in the lactose-reduced milk. Other people will either add drops to the dairy product as they use it so that they can use the same jug that the rest of the family uses, or take a tablet or a capsule that contains that enzyme at the same time, as long as it's down in your stomach so that your stomach can deal with it, no biggie. Some people are so intolerant. I had one little girl in my Girl Scout troop that literally took a bite of pudding once and had forgotten that it had milk in it, and she came to me green and said, "Does pudding have milk in it? Oops, you weren't in the group that made that, were you?" So there's a vast variety of differences. So milk or calcium, basically, intake in not only childhood but adolescence, which is the point where the bones are actually growing the fastest during that growth spurt of adolescence, and early adulthood are the times that we put down the calcium in our bones. After that, it's a matter of protecting it. Calcium balance becomes more and more important as we get older. There are very few studies that have shown any way to get more calcium in your bones. There are a few studies that have suggested this or that routine will actually add minute amounts of calcium, but mainly after about age 35, we're just centered on keeping what we've got.
So in other words, it doesn't do any good anymore to take calcium?
You still need to take the calcium because there's a constant calcium turnover. We're talking about you got to get it built because you're not, what we're trying to do at this at our age is hang on to it. Mm-hmm. And that does include a good calcium intake. The official minimum daily requirement is about 800 milligrams. For thinking processes, there's about 300 in a glass of milk. So in kind of units of glasses of milk, the minimum daily requirement is about 2 glasses of milk plus what you get in your regular food. If you eat a fair amount of greens and sprinkle a little cheese on your salad and don't count it otherwise, you can count on about 400 milligrams from just a basic general diet. That assumes you eat fruits and vegetables and not all milkshakes and hamburgers. There are foods now that are fortified with calcium. There's calcium fortified orange juice you can buy in the grocery store. There's calcium fortified cereals. There's calcium fortified yogurt. So you don't have to drink it. There are, at least not in a white glass. There are other ways. Milk, because of its balance with phosphorus and the fact that it's fortified with vitamin D, is still a good source, but it's not a necessary source if you just can't get the stuff down or if it upsets your stomach or whatever. The thing that we're seeing now is that perhaps for women who are approaching or have passed menopause, that probably there is additional advantage to 1,000 to 1,500 milligrams of calcium. Then we're getting up to, if you subtract your 400 for general diet, we're talking either 4 glasses of milk or about 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams in calcium tablets. I may be getting ahead of myself, but we should maybe talk about calcium tablets for a minute. There are a variety of different forms of calcium out there that you can buy. You cannot go to the store and buy straight calcium. It doesn't exist. Calcium is a positively charged ion, and you've got to have a negatively charged ion with it. And depending on which one you get, how much actual calcium there'll be. Calcium carbonate is the substitute that most of us recommend. It's cheap. It's relatively unbulky. You can get a 500 or 600 milligram tablet of calcium carbonate, so that we're talking a couple of tablets a day. You get down into calcium gluconate, and you can't put as much in a tablet because it's real bulky. It's only about 13% calcium, and you're all of a sudden you're popping 6, 7, 8 pills a day, plus the expense. A good generic calcium carbonate, money of 3 to 5 cents a piece. We should also talk about vitamin D. Vitamin D is the sunshine vitamin. Up here at Holden, you have absolutely no need for vitamin D. You walk from your lodge to the dining hall in your short sleeve shirt, you got it for the day. Those of us that live in the Midwest, where it's cold, and we bundle up with just our little noses showing, and we run into our garages and get in our cars and go park right next to where we work, we don't probably get it. Now, if you're a cross-country skier and you're out, even if you've got a hat and what on, not on, if you're out for a half an hour cross-country skiing, you're going to get your vitamin D. For those of us who don't do those things in the wintertime, and live in climates where we don't expose our skin, then we need to think about calcium D in, or vitamin D in the diet or in a supplement. Milk is, by law, fortified with vitamin D, unless you're buying raw milk from a farm, which I wouldn't recommend for a variety of other reasons. But for those that are taking calcium tablets, you need to think about it. Now, if you take a multivitamin, and for basically healthy people who eat a good variety of foods, I don't generally recommend them, because a variety diet is your best source of the vitamins that you need. But for people who are older, who may have a decreased intake, it takes at least 1,200 to 1,500 calories of balanced food to get all the vitamins you need. If it's not balanced, it takes more than that. People who have restrictions due to illness or who have additional needs due to illness may find a general multivitamin to be helpful. For those who do not have an ongoing blood loss, i.e. men, women past menopause, women who've had hysterectomies, we usually recommend that you take a multivitamin without iron. We talk so much about iron, 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 and if you've got periods, it's hard to get too much, because you don't absorb it very well and you're going to lose some each month. For growing kids, iron is important because the amount of iron they got when they from their parent, their mother when they were born, soon that's not a very large amount for this larger and larger person. But for those of us past menopause, we actually can overload on iron, even on just over the years, on even just a regular supplement. So, calcium, the one thing I would warn, if you find that calcium carbonate, for some reason you don't like it, is stay away from dolomite and from bone meal, because both of those sources of calcium are contaminated, in most cases, with small amounts of lead and arsenic and other heavy metals, which in any one individual pill is not poisonous, but over years of use, could result in an accumulation of metals that we don't get rid of. So straight generic calcium carbonate or oyster shell is okay. Oscal, which I think is one that most people are very familiar with, you really don't need to pay the money for it. Your chain drugstores will always have a generic sitting right next to it that's half the price. It's not a problem. The one case where calcium carbonate doesn't work very well is for people who are taking ulcer medications or who have had stomach surgery or who are vitamin B12 deficient, who for some reason do not have adequate acid in the stomach. If you take a calcium tablet and you drop it in a glass of water, it can sit there a long time and just sit there. You drop it in a glass of vinegar, which is very similar to the acidity of your stomach, and it'll bubble and foam and dissolve in 10 minutes. So it is important that calcium absorption is dependent on stomach acid, but that's not a problem for very many people. But if someone is taking Tagamet day in and day out for their hiatal hernia or something like that, it could be an issue.
Excuse me?
Sure.
Will you give the name of the... It's funny, you go to yours and it's funny, we so don't like my husband, he's been taking years calcium, and I guess we never paid any.
Oh.
But ever.
Okay.
He has asthma and they sort of.
Calcium carbonate. and you measure the elemental, regardless of what kind you get, it's the elemental calcium that counts. They will often say it's a gram of calcium carbonate. Well, that's going to be about 400 milligrams of elemental calcium. You're looking for somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 milligrams total, including dietary. And so you need to think about what's your diet like. You drink one, you put some milk on your cereal in the morning, you have a glass of milk before you go to bed. That's probably 400 there, plus your 400 for your fruits and for your vegetables and stuff. You're not talking a full 1,500 you have to get in pills. If you haven't touched a green vegetable in years and milk makes you gag just to look at it, then you're going to need to get the whole amount. Vitamin D is sun first. Question whether it's in your source of calcium. And the second would be a vitamin. The third would be a vitamin. If you've got a general multivitamin that has a minimum daily requirement of vitamin D, I don't think you necessarily have to go out and get something separate. There is some thought that as we grow older, that we do have, if any of you want some of these little brochures, I think some of this stuff about the amounts are in here if you don't want to try to write everything all down. There is some thought that a little extra vitamin D, more than the minimum daily requirement, may be appropriate. But vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin that you can overdose on. You don't think, 100% of the minimum daily requirement, oh, that's good, let's take 1,000. It doesn't work that way. So be sure that you're getting your minimum. If you get, 1.5 times your minimum, don't sweat it, but, don't go out and get mega doses. So we talked a little bit about calcium. Exercise is another good way to prevent osteoporosis. There's a couple of little glitches on exercise for osteoporosis. One is it doesn't have to be gung-ho, work up a sweat. Oh, I hate that stuff. It does need to be weight-bearing. So you can swim your head off and do a great job for your heart, and you haven't done anything for osteoporosis. On the other hand, the stroll 3 blocks down to the post office and back is probably enough for osteoporosis. So especially for people who have orthopedic problems or who for other reasons, angina or something, who don't feel that they can do all the stuff we'll talk about when we talk about aerobic exercise, you can still do a lot of good for osteoporosis. We've even got some fairly decent studies on nursing home patients that just talk about the simple little things you can do sitting in a wheelchair as being better than nothing. So daily weight-bearing something is appropriate. Then we're going to get into something that's a little controversial. I do need to try to, I think we're running out of room here. Yeah, I know. I'm going to try to do this one because we're going to need the room later. The next thing we need to look at is if this is years and this is calcium, our calcium builds, like we said, and then this is probably age 20 when we get our full growth. This is maybe 30 when we have our maximum calcium intake. Not much loss, and we're going to arbitrarily say this particular woman went through menopause at 50. Now we've got a problem in that at menopause, calcium loss really picks up. And in fact, that's really more of a curve than it is a straight slope. This is where we get into the controversy of to treat or not to treat menopause with hormones. And I think at this point, maybe we'll move on to menopause. The thing about treating osteoporosis, treating menopause with hormones, is if you start right at menopause, you can actually almost level out. It's still slightly downward, but it's pretty close to level, especially if you've got the exercise and the calcium. If you don't start treatment till 4 or 5 years after menopause, you're not going to put back that section that you've already lost. The big problem is that you don't wind up with symptoms until about 35% loss. And so one of our tasks has been to try to figure out who's going to have problems with osteoporotic fractures and who isn't. And frankly, there isn't anything that works very well. There are several tests, and because I don't use any of them, I'll just mention them, but not try to go into the details of which one does what. We can send x-ray, special x-ray beams, not the kind that you take to find out if you broke something, through your wrist. And the thing about that one isn't terribly expensive, and it's reasonably accurate. In other words, if I did your left wrist on Wednesday and then sent you across town and they did it on Friday, we come up with a pretty similar number. The problem is that that doesn't tell us much. It tells us just fine what's going on in your wrist and what your potential is to break your wrist, which is important, but not the one that disables women. It's fractures in the back and fractures of the hip that disable people. And this test, while it's nice for your wrist, doesn't say much about what's happening in your back or your hip. We can do CT scans of the lumbar spine, and that's pretty good for lumbar spine. They also cost $350 and are plus or minus 3%. And since you're losing on the average about 1-1.5% a year, we can't tell whether you are losing faster or slower than average till we've done 3 or 4 scans over a period of 5 years. We've now cost you $2,000 and we're still not sure if we know anything. It's not terribly practical. So at the moment, although I know places that are advertising, especially the dual photon spectrometry of the wrist, how useful it is just doesn't really seem to match up. There's too little difference between, if you're losing 0.5% a year, you're probably doing just great. And if you're losing 2% a year, you're probably doing pretty badly. And if you're 1%, you're probably about average. But how long it takes us to figure out which group you're really in is just unreasonable. So we come down to menopause. And of course, menopause is the time we're running into trouble here. You don't usually have the fractures till about 15 years later. But by then, we're down below that threshold. Even if we arrest things there, we may improve your risk. But we're talking about a woman who's had one fracture of a vertebrae in her back has about 120% risk she'll do it again in the next year. Meaning that some women will have 2 or 3 and some women won't have any, but the average one is going to have at least one more. Once we've reached that threshold, it's going to keep happening. My grandmother's 98, now just about any kind of prevention is going to have sort of worn out by that point. But she hardly gets one heal when she's got another one. It's just kind of, well, how's grandma this week? Yeah, we're still improving. Oop, how's grandma this week? Oh, she got another one. So it's definitely an issue that you want to catch before we start to have the slippery slope of fractures. In the back, especially, they just kind of keep going. In the hip, that's another story. The risk of fracture of the hip is about double for women who have not taken hormones after menopause compared to those that have. And certainly you have to say, how equal are the comparison groups? And there are some groups that would do better, such as heavy black women have fewer fractures than skinny white women. Both the skinny and the racial group make a difference. Smokers have more fractures than non-smokers. Some of those things we can control. We can control whether we smoke. We can't control whether we're black or white. To some extent, we can't control whether we're a large bone person or a small bone person. But we can work on things like adequate calcium intake, exercise, stopping smoking. But the big one, even if you do all the things that you can, and stopping smoking, you know, taking the calcium, and getting the exercise, that does about 15 to 20% of the bone protection. And the other 80 to 90% of bone protection that we can get comes from hormones. I think when we talk hormones, there certainly are some good points and bad points to treating menopause with hormones. And I don't know of anyone who would say every woman ought to take hormones. And I hope there aren't too many people who say no woman should take hormones. I think that it's up to each individual woman, and I've had this discussion fairly heatedly with somebody here in the village, that every woman should take a look at how it fits for her. If you have hot flashes and dryness in the vaginal area and trouble making it to the bathroom from the time that you think I need to go until you're sitting on the can, and you don't have a uterus, I think it's a no-brainer. You ought to try it, because the downside of taking hormones is primarily the nuisance of having periods back again, which doesn't always happen. We can get into ways that you could prevent that, maybe. And the risk of cancer of the lining of the uterus. If you haven't got a uterus, the two big negatives are gone. Bingo. You're not there. Estrogen, I don't think we should get into that quite yet. On the other hand, if your grandmother lived to be 90 and was ramrod straight the whole time, you've been an exercise freak who's drank your milk all the time, and you try hormones and they make you nauseated and your breasts hurt and you bleed at all the wrong times, maybe it's not worth it. Or you've had a precancerous condition of the lining of the uterus in the past or something. There are certainly people for whom the benefits just don't outweigh the risks. For most of us, I think we're sitting in the middle, that some of the side effects of hormones may be a nuisance. You clearly have to go to the doctor. You should go to the doctor once a year at that age for a checkup anyway, but you may be making additional visits, especially when you initially start hormones, to see how they work for you. There's the expense, and I've certainly had women who said, you know, $75 every 3 months. Well, I'm glad you don't have an ulcer, because that's $75 once a month. But it's still a budgetary issue. I'm sure that everybody's got something else they could do with $600 a month. Or, I'm sorry, with $300 a year, I don't deny that. The whole hassle of remembering to take medicine, it's a pain in the butt. I don't do very well at it.
But if you're late past the age, do you still recommend it? Do you still try it?
Well, I think that depends, and that's something that a woman in her own individual position. I have a lady of 80 that had a compression fracture and started hormone replacement at that point in time, and has done better in general with the achy back, etc., since doing so. She also had some bleeding, and we had a good long talk about, well, usually when you have bleeding at unexpected times, we do a procedure where we take a sample, and she, with a lot of other health problems, said, thanks, but no thanks. If I've got a cancer, I'm not doing anything about it anyway. End of story. But I think for younger women, I also have younger women for whom a biopsy isn't a whole lot worse than a pap smear. It's an office procedure. It takes about 5 minutes. And I have a lot of women who say, well, yeah, I don't have pap smears if I don't have to, because it's not particularly fine to lay there with your legs up in the air. But it isn't a big deal. I have other women who, you know, and say that they wouldn't ever dream of having one of those awake again. I think there are some tricks. There are some tricks that can be done that make them more comfortable. And frankly, 10% of women have a different type of pain receptor in that area than others. I have women who say pap smears hurt. For 90% of women, taking a pap smear is something you don't even notice. The speculum, yes. The pap smear itself, no. But there's about 10% of women that have some real pain fibers in that area that the rest of us don't. And I think we have to acknowledge that, and I feel badly when somebody says that they were told that it was all in their head, because there are lots of things about our bodies. Some people have an extra nipple, some people have eyebrows that aren't the same one side to the other. I think everybody's a little bit different. But I think that all comes into play. I have a lot of women who decide after looking at osteoporosis, I guess two other things we should talk about are heart disease and breast cancer, because those are two things that are at least associated with hormones. It's pretty clear that estrogen, the main female hormone that we treat hot flashes with and that causes us to protect our bones from osteoporosis, estrogen is clearly beneficial in making good changes in our lipid profiles and reduces the risk of heart disease. There are people who are thoughtful who would suggest that no woman should take progesterone along with her estrogen, that because of the good that the estrogen does to the heart, that we should accept that small increased risk of cancer of the lining of the uterus, which is the major reason we give the other hormone, progesterone, with estrogen replacement therapy for women who have uteruses. Because we know how much good the estrogen does for your heart, and heart disease is far, far, far more prevalent than cancer of the lining of the uterus. But when I sit in the exam room and I tell people that statistically they'd be better off to take the estrogen alone, they hear the big C and they don't hear anymore. Estrace? Yes. Estrace is a form of estrogen. Probably the second most common form used. Most physicians prescribe conjugated estrogens for protection from menopause, probably the thing that's been studied the most. I get a few patients who find out where those come from and get a little put off. They come actually from the urine of pregnant horses. It's purified, but you know, the slimy mold to get your antibiotics off of aren't any more gross. The ground up cow thyroid gland to get your old fashioned thyroid medication from. We've been taking medications from strange places for years. The plants out here that have the sign "Do not touch" are foxglove. That's where we get digitalis. I mean, there's all kinds of places we get medications from. But estrace is an artificial form of estrogen produced in the test tube, and it's also a very fine one. Some women who have a side effect with one particular type of estrogen may do better on a different one. Someone who gets very tender breasts or who gets nauseated may do better with some other form. At any rate, the estrogen does 90 to 95% of the protection of our bones. The progesterone does only 5 to 10%. So most of the time when women do not have a uterus, so we're not worried about uterus cancer, we say estrogen alone. And I find that most women tolerate estrogen very well, especially if they're either fairly close to menopause or if they start slowly and build up. I've got one 82-year-old lady with recurrent compression fractures who's tried it several times, and we've even tried just little itty bitty, you know, a half a pill every 3 days kind of thing, and she comes back and says, "I can't stand how much it hurts in the chest," but that's fairly uncommon.
But how about the extra, and that also affects your breast, that you
sure
are increasing the risk of that.
Well,
if you have the chronic cystic problem when you're younger, then I was told never to use it.
Yeah, the chronic cystic problem was thought to be more associated with breast cancer than it's panned out to be. Mm-hmm. Plain fibrocystic breast condition, I hate anytime I hear the word disease attached to that. It gets confusing. We sometimes have to do something with a cyst because we can't tell for sure that's what it is. But there is no evidence that simple cysts make you any more prone to cancer. They do make you a little bit more prone to tenderness when you take estrogen. Caffeine is also associated with breast tenderness with estrogens. And I strongly advise women who are concerned about tenderness to knock off the caffeine, and which is doing you no good. and see if that makes a difference. And I've seen some women do remarkably better that way, but not all. And I've also seen women who be hanged if they're going to give up their coffee so that they may or may not have fewer compression factors. As far as breast cancer is concerned, our risks as modern American women of getting breast cancer are about like this. Literally hundreds of studies out there, and they now do something called meta-analysis where they put studies together. And most studies of estrogens at menopause can't find a statistical difference between this much and either this much or this much. The study, there have been a few studies, there's probably 10 good studies that say your risk of breast cancer increases by this much, and there are 10 good studies that say it decreases by this much when you take hormones. The difference in the breast cancer risk of getting it in the first place if you take estrogens is probably pretty close to a wash. Nobody has really pinned that one down, but we're probably talking a disease that affects probably 11 or 12% of us that we're going to increase or decrease by some fraction of 1%. It is very clear that if you have breast cancer that is has positive estrogen receptors, it will grow faster while you take estrogen. And so since breast cancers usually exist for about 10 years before they're detected, careful attention to watching for breast cancer so that if the interval between the onset and the detectable time is shortened by taking the estrogen. A lot of these studies, frankly, women who take hormones tend to be more tuned into getting their mammograms, doing their self-exams, getting their physician exams, getting their biopsy if they've got a lump kind of thing. That some of the difference in incidence of breast cancer may be due to early detection. The actual death rate from breast cancer doesn't seem to be different among women who've taken hormones over or haven't. But clearly women who've had breast cancer, no, they probably shouldn't take hormones. Women who actively have a blood clot in their legs, no, they shouldn't take hormones. It's clear that the doses of hormones and birth control pills, especially the birth control pills that were used 20 years ago, do cause an increased risk of blood clots. There are excellent studies that the clotting factors, the things that help us to not bleed to death, don't change with the doses that are commonly used for estrogen replacement therapy. So I tell women that I think breast cancer is a bit of a wash. I guess the other thing that I think we have to face is our modern American diet does a lot more for breast cancer than whether or not you take estrogen. If you're concerned about breast cancer and you want to do something about it, cut the fat out of your diet. Cut the cake, the pie, the meat, and you'll do much more for your risk of breast cancer than you will by taking or not taking estrogen, frankly. It's real clear that Japanese women who eat a Japanese traditional diet, lots of rice and seaweed and a little fish, fairly low-fat diet, have a much, much lower risk of breast cancer. First-generation Japanese women in America who still eat mostly a traditional diet and who maybe had a traditional diet during childhood have an intermediate risk. And second and third-generation Japanese women who have a thoroughly American lifestyle have the same breast cancer risk that you and I do. Come to our lecture on nutrition or read the whole food philosophy. You can do more for breast cancer. I think some women have side effects from hormone replacement therapy. Periods are one of them. If people want to get into it, we can talk about some of the different patterns. If we want to use progesterone to protect the uterus from uterus cancer. Uterus cancer is a fairly uncommon condition. If breast cancer is like this, uterus cancer is like this. Uterus cancer detected early is almost always curable, quite simply. Unlike breast cancer that by the time it's detected has a significant risk of spread, yes, totally neglected, uterus cancer can definitely kill people. But most uterus cancer, you do something about it and it's gone. And it won't be back to haunt you. And while nobody wants to have surgery or radiation therapy or whatever, it's not quite the same thing as having a lung cancer or something of that sort where the cure rates are low. If we use hormone replacement therapy with estrogen alone, we double or even more than that increase the risk of precancerous, probably 8 to 10-fold increased risk after a number of years of precancerous conditions of the uterus. That's why women who have a uterus who take estrogen alone are usually advised to get a biopsy of the lining of the uterus on a yearly basis. If the lining looks perfectly normal, not precancerous, no biggie. If it's mildly abnormal, think about what you're going to do about it. Are you going to take progesterone? Are you going to quit the estrogen? Or are you going to watch it a little more closely? If it's precancerous, then yeah, you need to do something about it, because instead of being maybe 1 in 1,000 instead of 1 in 100,000, now you're right up there. But by and large, estrogen alone, if your biopsy is normal, that biopsy is pretty good evidence that you're going to be okay there. The progesterone will decrease your risk of lining of the uterus lower than if you took no hormones at all. The reason for that is we all make estrogen, even after menopause. Even if you have your ovaries out, your adrenal glands back here, the same ones that make cortisone that are right above your kidneys, also make some estrogen. That's why some women don't have hot flashes. There are two kinds of hot flashes. One kind of hot flash is the ones you have right at menopause. And if right at the time that you stop having your periods, or even just a little before you stop having your periods, estrogen levels are way up here when you're in the childbearing years. And even if you're going to have some estrogen after menopause, it's down in here. That quick change will give most women some hot flashes. Now there's two kinds. One kind is you have really rotten hot flashes right around that time that I missed a period and then I got it, and I haven't had one for 3 months, so I got one more. Now it's been 6 months and I haven't had a period. Yeah, I think I'm getting over it. Yeah, you know, the hot flashes are getting better too. That type is just from the change. And those can go away on their own. People who say, oh, just wait your hot flashes out. If she's already done it and she said, oh, my hot flashes went away, that's what happened with her. Her natural low level of estrogens, still probably not enough to be protective of her bones, but at least will keep her from throwing the covers off and on and off and on all night long. She's lucky in that respect. But some women go down to such an absolutely low level and keep slowly dropping a little bit more that they're going to have hot flashes forever. So women who have hot flashes...
Good, because that's me. Yeah, I was worried about it.
Yeah. Women who have hot flashes of that type are not likely to get rid of them unless they take hormones. And relatively small doses of hormones can make a big difference. And when there are long-term goods to be gained by taking them, such as arresting the bone loss, and even if you didn't get it right up at the top of that peak, you know, this lady here still is above that symptomatic level where she's likely to get fractures. Now, if she quits, she's going to be closer than this gal. She doesn't have the same cushion that this gal does between the risk and not risk. You know, we can all break an arm. I drink my milk all the time. I still have periods. Oh my gosh, do I? I fell down and broke my wrist last fall. Makes me real nervous about taking my hormones when I get to be that age. But my mother-in-law has broken both wrists, and she also has the hunchback that says that she's already had some collapse of her vertebrae, even though she hasn't had a painful fracture. That lady's got osteoporosis. I don't have to x-ray her. I can just walk in the room and see, here's the back that doesn't fit in the clothes, and you fractured both wrists. You know, one of them she slipped in the grocery store, and the other one she slipped on the ice, but neither one of them were a particularly, you know, big time fall. So that kind of person, you know, that's pretty clear. For somebody like yourself, I think you just have to, you have to weigh things. But like I said at the very beginning, the woman who has no symptoms, no family history, and side effects, maybe it's not for her. The known ill effects outweigh the potential down the road benefit. I have no crystal balls. They don't work very well. That's why they go to the circus and stay in the dark, and I don't have one. My retrospectoscope works really well, though. That's the one that looks backwards and says, gee, if you took hormones 10 years ago, it might have prevented this. That's not helpful. It doesn't do any good. But that's why I think women who are on the balance, yeah, I've got a few symptoms. I know I don't have a uterus. I'm not going to get periods back. They aren't going to be bugging me about biopsies. Need to think seriously. Fractured hips are the number two cause of nursing home admission. Number one right now, I think, is Alzheimer's or other dementing illnesses. But number two is fractured hips, and the statistics for women over 65, or for anyone over 65 who breaks a hip, are really pretty abysmal. Approximately half of the people over 65 that break a hip will wind up permanently in a nursing home. Now, certainly, I have a lovely lady who still works, who's 67, who fell and broke her hip, and you know, she was playing golf 5 times a week before she broke her hip. She was certainly an active lady, someone that I don't consider old by any means. She broke her hip. She didn't wind up in a nursing home, but she can't play golf anymore. She's had her hip pinned, she's had it replaced, and maybe 6 months after her replacement, which was only about 3 months ago, maybe she'll be able to play a little golf again if she takes a cart. That lady used to walk 18 holes 5 times a week. That's made a big change in her lifestyle. Also, of the people who wind up in nursing homes, between a quarter and a half of those will die within a year. Approximately a quarter of people who, and I don't see it in my practice. This is what I see in the literature. But because fractured hips lead to immobility, they lead to institutionalization. We're not talking each individual person. I certainly wouldn't say if one of you broke your hip, you know, you have a 25% chance of dying, because a lot of people who break hips were already in nursing homes to start with. But what I'm saying is there is a significant potential. You may develop a blood clot, you may develop pneumonia, you may develop malnutrition, you may develop depression, directly related to the fact that you're not doing what you used to do. And I think most people who have fractured a hip just aren't quite what they used to be afterwards, and prevention is the name of the game. Certainly another form of secondary prevention is preventing falls. Things like being careful about scatter rugs and lights on stairs and things of that sort are part of the whole, you know, we don't just prevent osteoporotic fractures by one thing. It's not estrogen, it's not calcium, it's a little bit of everything that we need to look at. But they're definitely not to be taken lightly. As far as the periods, women who start hormones at menopause itself, who take what we call cyclic hormones, where you take your estrogen a certain part of the month, and during the last part of that you take the progesterone, mimicking the natural menstrual cycle, because in a normal menstrual cycle you make estrogen the whole cycle, you only make progesterone after ovulation, the second half of the cycle. Women who take that type of pattern, about 80 to 90% will get periods. The advantage to that program is that almost all women will bleed only when they're supposed to. It will be predictable, and your doctor will not say, oh, I need to do a biopsy. They will say, oh, good, you're bleeding when you're supposed to. I'm sorry you're bleeding, but it's all right. The other way to do it is to take a very small dose of the progesterone throughout the entire month, and that reduces the bleeding to about 15%. The problem is that whole 15% is abnormal, and we're chasing you around going, you know, I really think you ought to have a biopsy, and you're running out the door saying, no, I don't think I want to have a biopsy. So we find that that pattern works best with women who have already taken the cyclic hormones and bled at the right times on the cyclic hormones, but just hate it. They get crabby or something before, they have PMS type symptoms with their progesterone, or they have bad cramps with their periods, or they have very heavy bleeding with their periods because they always did. You'll tend to have less bleeding with estrogen replacement therapy than you did with natural periods. But sometimes that's not a great deal of comfort, depending on what your periods were like. They also tend to get lighter over time. The longer you take hormones, the lighter the periods get. And if they disappear, that's fine. Even if you're on the cyclic hormones, if you don't get a period, that's a bonus. You don't need a period as long as we know that you've taken the progesterone, so that if there's something in there that needs to come out, it does. The nice thing about the continuous is there are some women, we have not determined what the ideal amount of progesterone is to give a woman to protect that lining of the uterus. The old standard is 10 milligrams for 10 days. That's 100 milligrams a month. I see a lot of women who get a little bloated, who get a little headachy, who feel a little bit ishy, either right when they start or right when they stop. And some of them say, I've had it, I don't like this, I got rid of that when I stopped having periods, I'm not going to do that again. And I say, fine, now we've got other alternatives for you. And others will say, yeah, it kind of feels a little PMS-y, but I handled that for years, I can still handle it. We've tried over the years to decrease that amount of hormone, and a lot of us are using 5 milligrams for 14 days, which seems to have pretty good evidence that it's the same effectiveness. I see a lot of women who feel kind of a little funny on 10 milligrams, but they don't feel badly on 5. Great. On the other hand, if you feel ishy on 5 milligrams, just like you did on 10, you're ishy for 14 days instead of for 10. Big help. Also, progesterone may take some of the good away from what estrogen does for your cholesterol. There's some debate on that. There's some of the newest literature that says that progesterone at certain doses is also protective of your cholesterol. That one hasn't washed out. But basically right now what we're saying is the least progesterone you have to take to hold the lining of your uterus in proper shape is probably the best. The other one now is to take 2.5 milligrams, which is a quarter of that original 10 milligram dose, and either to take it all the time, which still winds up at about 70 milligrams a month, just like the 14 days of 5 milligrams, which for cholesterol's sake is, you know, that looks a little better than 100 to me. I've seen some people using the 2.5 times 14 days also, especially for women who are saying, you know, I really don't like being on progesterone, but I like the idea of protecting the lining of my uterus, or not having to worry about when I'm going to bleed, that I'm going to bleed at the right time, if I bleed at all. There's beginning to be good literature that the 2.5 all the time protects the lining of your uterus equally well with the other two programs. The literature for the 2.5 for 14 days just isn't there yet. There's nothing that says it doesn't work, but there just isn't a lot there that says it does yet. So we're still kind of waiting on that one. Now this has been a group that's been pretty good about button in, and that's great, I love it. But I was supposed to leave some time for questions, and we're now kind of running out. I can stick around, but I don't want to keep other people. Any questions, comments, ideas? This is certainly a sharing session, not just a lecture.
If you don't have the uterus, then you don't need the
progesterone.
Yeah.
No. I've seen one or two people who have suggested that that extra 5% protection of your bones might be worth it, but in general, because we still don't know for sure what progesterone is doing to your cholesterol, which frankly your heart disease is at least as much of an issue as osteoporosis, I don't recommend it. And I think that 90% of the side effects from hormone therapy come from progesterone. I get a few women with tender breasts, I get a few women with nausea, but I really don't see that much of it. Nausea, you can get around with the patches. I guess I should mention the patches. I get a lot of patients who come in and say, oh, well, why can't they have that new patch? Well, for one thing, the new patch costs about 50% more than the other stuff, which I think is a big ripoff. The other is that I'm getting about a 10 to 20% allergy rate to the patches. Whatever the glue is that makes them stick to you. I had one lady who did, and there's a lot of little tricks you can use to try to keep that under control and keep it down. And the tricks sometimes work. I had one lady who came in with buttons down her rear end. She had, you change the patch twice a week, and after a month she had 8 little red circles that itched.
Mm-hmm. Oh boy.
So if you're going to take estrogen alone and you have problems with nausea or something like that, the patches can be really nice. Frankly, I think it's hard enough to remember to do something once a day. I don't know how I would remember that I'm supposed to do something on Monday morning and Thursday afternoon. Frankly, they keep talking about how convenient it is. You only have to do it twice a week. Well, I'd never remember to do it twice a week. Stick something once a day with my toothbrush and I might remember it. But then again, it's an individual thing. I have a few women on the patches, principally ones with the nausea. Nausea has to do with when you take a pill and it lands in your stomach and then your liver has to do something with it, you can get nauseated from it. If you stick it on your skin, on your rear end, then it gets directly into your bloodstream and there's never a large lump of it in your liver. And that's where most of the nausea comes from. So that's one place where I can see the patches being real helpful. But otherwise, I try to save money. Yeah.
Is the idea that once a person is on the hormones, that you continue on them for that, like forever?
Well, at this point, and I think that's something that I have to say, I've seen enough change in the 15 years I've been in this business, 16 years I've been in this business, that I'm waiting for the next chapter. But because we do see that quick drop-off as soon as you stop,
right,
we're postponing that quick drop-off, we're not preventing it mm-hmm. entirely, that you're welcome to stop about 5 years before you're planning to kick the bucket. you know,
yeah.
That's,
no, I just thought, yeah, is there years,
yeah,
that you
it's think? Pretty much, and frankly, I think the women who do well with hormone therapy, mm-hmm. there really isn't a reason to stop. And certainly, you know, that assumes that you're healthy and that you're active, and I certainly don't think that messing with hormones is appropriate if you're on death's door from 3 other things and a demented total care patient. I mean, what good is preventive therapy when your life expectancy is low anyway? I mean, even if you had metastatic lung cancer, non-hormone dependent, I'd still probably stop your estrogen. You've got enough other stuff to deal with. You don't need to take something that's going to interact with your other medicines. But I think that we have a lot of women. One of the things I should say about menopause, and another argument that I get is that, well, menopause is natural. Why should I mess with something natural? Traditionally, up until the era of antibiotics and improved nutrition, basically the average life expectancy wasn't much past menopause. Now that's somewhat artificial. There have always been people that have lived to 100, but there's been, and there have also been women who died in childbirth or from accidents or something that, you know, you match one person that's 100 with 3 people that are 30 when they die, and you wind up with an average that's, you know, around 50 or something. But it's only been the last 40 or 50 years that we've had a large number of otherwise active, healthy women living 20, 30, 40, 45 years after menopause. And since you don't see the side effects of that estrogen loss for about 15 years, if the average woman kicks the bucket 10 years after menopause, osteoporosis isn't a problem. But the average life expectancy for a woman who makes it to 50 right now is somewhere around 82, 83. And of course that varies. If you're a diabetic and you've already had a heart attack, I don't expect you're going to live to be 83 if you're 50. But for women who are otherwise quite healthy, I think there's a real issue there. And I don't think that any particular time is too late for an active, otherwise healthy woman to at least consider what that might or might not do for her. Certainly, I get really ticked at women who I've talked to at 50, who come back at 55 or 60 and say, oh, you know, maybe I want to do that hormone thing now. And I'm going, ooh, you could have done yourself a lot more good early on. But on the other hand, the past is gone. We have only the future. And while the benefit may not be as great, there is still benefit there. And especially for symptoms. Because women who have symptoms have 100% potential for improvement. Women who don't have a 10% chance that this treatment is going to make a big difference in their lives. If you don't take estrogen and you've got an average risk, you probably still have less than a 10% chance you're going to have a serious fracture. But once it happens, it's 100%. I'm not personally somebody who's willing to gamble.